Live from the nation's capital, President Joe Biden and comedian Colin Jost headlined the White House Correspondents' Dinner. See all the biggest stars together in one room live April 27th at 8 p.m. on CNN and streaming on Max.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Character matters. Decency matters. Civility never goes out of style.
Former Arizona Senator Jeff Flake, one of the first senior Republicans to turn on Trump, makes the conservative case for Joe Biden. And Vanity Fair plays tribute to Breonna Taylor's beautiful life. I'm joined by editor-in-chief Radhika Jones and the September issue's guest editor, esteemed author Ta-Nehisi Coates. Plus,
Donald Trump and Ronald Reagan were very different people.
Historian Rick Perlstein takes us to Reagan land. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. A week of politics and protest across the United States ends with a massive march on Washington, 57 years to the day after Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. On exactly the same hallowed spot today, they demand racial justice and reform. This comes a day after President Trump wrapped up the Republican convention on the White House lawn, not so far away. And the election campaign now heads into its final phase. President Trump enjoys strong support from Republicans, but more and more high-level party members are coming out publicly to say they just can't vote for him. Former Arizona Senator Jeff Flake is a leader in the Republican anti-Trump movement. Indeed, it was 4 years ago when he first came out and said that he wouldn't vote for the GOP candidate. But this year, he's going a step further. Flake says he'll vote for the Democrat, Joe Biden, and he's calling it the only way to save conservatism.
Indifference to the truth or to the careful stewardship of the institutions of American liberty is not conservative. Disregard for the separation of powers, the centerpiece of our constitutional system, is not conservative. Governing by tweet is not conservative. It's not even governing.
Well, that was his statement, and now the man himself joins me from Utah. Senator Flake, welcome to the program. So let's put it right out there. You're a conservative. You have never voted for a Democrat, and yet you've said what you've said, and you're going to do what you're going to do. What is the conservative case for Joe Biden?
Well, conservatives believe in preserving and conserving, institutions to preserve what we know works. And the institutions of American democracy are freedom of the press, for example, or separation of powers, independent judiciary. And the president has shown that he either little understands or little appreciates these institutions. So I'm not pretending that Joe Biden is as conservative as I am on fiscal issues and whatnot, but on those important issues of American democracy, frankly, he's more conservative than the president is.
So let me ask you the converse question, because, of course, I mean, left unsaid was that Joe Biden is running on a progressive platform, as you know. I mean, almost FDR-like, New Deal-like. The president is doing the opposite. You've just had this week of convention. You talked about fiscal issues. The president has cut taxes. People seem to love that. He's still regarded as solid on the economy. He's appointed right. Hundreds of conservative judges. What is the conservative case against President Trump?
The conservative case is that we're running the Republican Party into the ground. We lost the House of Representatives in the midterms. We stand a good shot of losing the Senate this time. I think we've lost several hundred legislative seats in state capitals nationwide, and we're headed toward a demographic cul-de-sac. We could well, if the president is reelected, lose Texas within 4 years if this kind of brand of Republicanism, this Trumpism, takes hold and keeps the party. So the case that can be made for conservatism is there's just no future for Trumpism. And so we need a break. I would like to have a Republican in office. Obviously, Republicans are more conservative in general than Democrats on issues that I care about, like fiscal issues. But there's just no future for the party under Trumpism.
So I want to ask you about the so-called aha moment, your eureka moment. When did you decide, I mean, beyond not voting for Trump, that not only were you going to vote for Joe Biden, but that you were going to come out publicly as you are doing right now and even gathering others, like-minded other members right. of the party? What was the moment that sort of tipped you over the top?
Well, the moment they nominated Joe Biden. You know, I've been asked over the past 4 years, could you vote for a Democrat for president? I voted for Democrats on other, you know, for other offices, but never for president. And I said, you know, my ready answer was, if he or she were a Joe Biden kind of Democrat, then I could. Well, the Democrats nominated a Joe Biden kind of Democrat. So when he was nominated, and also I think as we go further into this presidency, we see the danger is not just to the party and what that means in the long term, but to you know, governing in general. We desperately need somebody like Joe Biden who can at least create the civic space where Republicans and Democrats can argue about policy again. Right now, that's not really possible. So when they nominated Joe Biden, I knew all along that I couldn't vote for Donald Trump, but I'd entertain thoughts, as many of my colleagues have, of you know, just voting for a third party candidate or writing somebody in. But I think it's important that we not just register our disapproval of the president, but we elect somebody in his place, and somebody like Joe Biden. And we just come out of a primary. Let's face it, both parties run to the left or right to where the party base is during a primary. But one thing that impressed me is during that primary, when it would have been more popular to say otherwise, Joe Biden kept saying, I'm going to work with Republicans. You need to work with Republicans. This is how the system works. And he has been in the Senate for so long. He knows how to negotiate. He knows how the system works and how to get policy that actually endures. So I think when the nomination happened, I knew that I would not only you know, not vote for Donald Trump, but would be able to vote for the Democrat.
Well, let's just put what Donald Trump said to the convention on the last night. And this is the sort of the anti-Biden case that he put. Let's just play a little bit of it.
If the left gains power, they will demolish the suburbs, confiscate your guns, and appoint justices who will wipe away your Second Amendment and other constitutional freedoms. Biden is a Trojan horse for socialism. If Joe Biden doesn't have the strength to stand up to wild-eyed Marxists like Bernie Sanders and his fellow radicals, and there are many, many, we see them all the time, it's incredible, actually, then how is he ever going to stand up for you? He's not.
So, Senator Flake, I want you to comment on that, because he paints obviously a completely different portrait of Joe Biden than right. you do. But also, we've seen in this week at the convention that what's been happening in Kenosha, Wisconsin, has been sort of morphed into, I mean, for want of a better word, a campaign strategy. The fear card mm-hmm. is being played. Yeah. Just tell me, I mean, do you agree with that? And how likely is that to work?
Well, in terms of his, you know, his description of Joe Biden defeated the other candidates, including Bernie Sanders. He won. And so I think that to try to paint him as a wide-eyed socialist is just a bit disingenuous. With regard to this law and order strategy, I do think that it does rally the base and some beyond the base as well. This, you know, this creates real danger for Democrats, if these kind of protests and violent protests and shootings go on. But I don't think it will be enough. For one, I think people, and I'm sure Joe Biden and the Democrats will point out, you know, this is happening on Donald Trump's watch. And 4 years from now, there weren't these kind of riots going on and whatnot. So for Donald Trump to place the blame solely with the Democrats just won't work very well.
So this is what Joe Biden said yesterday to Anderson Cooper at CNN about the violence and about how it's being played in the Republican election campaign.
He continues to root for violence. It's the country will be substantially safer when he is no longer in office. And I'm going to work to calm the tensions and root out systemic racism. I'm going to lead.
You think he's actually rooting for violence? That he wants violence because it allows him to claim a law and order mantle?
Sure, and because it takes everybody's eye off the ball.
Senator, what's your response to that, and particularly the question about the law and order mantle?
Well, I'm not going to go there whether or not the president wants violence. I don't think anybody does. But I do think to the extent that the Democratic Party and those running for office embrace this defund the police, then that is politically a gift to Republicans. Because that is not, but gratefully, that is not where Joe Biden is. He's made it clear that he does not embrace that part of that movement, but he will look to root out systemic racism, which I hope he does. So I think that there are dangers there for Democrats, depending on how it's played. But I don't see that danger as much with Joe Biden leading the ticket.
Interesting. Even Kellyanne Conway, the president's senior advisor, admitted on television yesterday that any violence in response to the shooting of unarmed black men, is likely to be in favor of President Trump. But let me put this to you, because you just mentioned racial justice. Obviously, this amazing march on Washington is going on, and there just have been so many people killed. This is what the great NBA coach Doc Rivers said. He said it a few days ago, but I want to play it to you because it just is like a stab to the heart.
All you hear is Donald Trump and all of them talking about fear. We're the ones getting killed. We're the ones getting shot. We're the ones that we're denied to live in certain communities. We've been hung, we've been shot, and all you do is keep hearing about fear. It's amazing to me why we keep loving this country and this country does not love us back.
So emotional, and it's taken a lot of people, got them in the solar plexus that the country does not love us back. Just how do you respond to that? What would you say to Doc Rivers, to Jacob Blake's family, to everybody out there who wants just basic justice?
Hey, they're heard. That's what's been so wonderful to see after the George Floyd shooting is that not just those who are effective and those who are victims, but everyone going out and protesting peacefully and saying this does need to change. It's gone on long enough. So I would say that it is heard. It's heard by many, and some will take advantage of it for political reasons. But I think it's being heard like never before. I think many of us who have not seen the extent of it or understood the extent of it are in a better position to do so now, and that's a wonderful, wonderful thing.
So let me get back to the race between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, and your state particularly. I mean, it's pretty reliable red state, conservative. The party there is all out for President Trump. But we're seeing, and there's evidence according to polling, that many women, particularly in the suburbs, are moving away. We hear a Republican strategist out there tell the newspapers, and I'm going to quote it for you, in red states like ours, you've got to hold your Republicans and convince your independents. Right now, we are losing both. Can you tell me what you make of that and how you analyze where your state is going to go?
Well, I think that was an accurate statement. The difficulty in Arizona, obviously, to win a Republican primary, you've got to be with the president. But to win statewide in a general election, unless you show some kind of independence from the president, then you're likely not going to prevail. And that's the difficulty. Senate candidates and gubernatorial candidates and others will have in the future. And right now, Mitt Romney carried Arizona, I think, by 11 or 12 points. Donald Trump carried Arizona by 3.5 and is in very much danger of losing it this time. And so I do think that, you know, in terms of suburban women, minorities, Gen Xers, millennials, a lot of them have been, you know, walking away from the party for a while. I think since the party has turned toward Trump, I think they're in a dead sprint away from the party. And it's going to be very difficult for Republicans to win statewide in states like Arizona or 4 years from now. You know, if Texas goes blue, how in the world does any Republican put together a coalition of states to win in the Electoral College? And that's the danger of embracing the president and his conduct and his behavior and many of his policies.
So 95%, according to the polls, of Republicans support President Trump. You have, you know, you're amongst many Republicans, you're former Congress people, we've seen national security people, legal people, many, many Republicans groups are coming out like you against President Trump and saying that really, you know, they will vote for Joe Biden. How do you think that'll sway a lot of people, or do you think this 95% in general is going to stick, despite what we've just talked about, the suburban women who are, as we saw at the convention, right, a main target of this campaign as well?
Yeah. Well, I don't think that it'll sway a lot of those who are self-identified Republicans who are with the president. But remember, in Arizona and many states now, you almost have one-third registered Republican, one-third Democrat, one-third independent. And so you don't have to move, you know, many Republicans, self-identified Republicans who are already voting for the president, move independents or those who are looking for an alternative. You don't have to move many to change a state.
Just very quickly, in our last few seconds, what has been the personal cost for you of basically going, you know, against your tribe?
Well, this is we're very tribal as a country now. It's been difficult, I have to say. When people will hear, and that's why I wanted to give a speech and explain my reasons why, I find that when people you know, will listen or read about it, they'll understand. But right now, we've been conditioned to believe that you know, your opponent is not just your opponent, but your enemy, and we put that in a party context. And so people see this as betrayal of your party and your principles when you're simply voting for another candidate. I hope we can get back, and I think we will, to a time when people will put country over party and support the right person regardless of the party.
Senator Jeff Flake, thank you so much for joining me. Now, the shooting of Jacob Blake in Wisconsin, seven times in the back, is the latest reminder of the lethal cost of racial inequality. His father is saying that Blake asked from his hospital bed why they shot him so many times. Here he is speaking today at that March on Washington.
There are two systems of justice in the United States. There's a white system and there's a black system. The black system ain't doing so well.
Indeed, Jacob Blake's story echoes that of Breonna Taylor's, the 26-year-old emergency medical technician who was shot eight times by police in her own home in March. Unlike Blake, Taylor did not survive, but her name is synonymous with the Black Lives Matter protest that is gripping the nation and the world. A portrait of Taylor is now the cover of Vanity Fair's September issue, which is dedicated to art, activism, and power in the 21st century America. Few contemporary writers have deconstructed racial injustice like Ta-Nehisi Coates, who guest edited this issue, and he's joining me now alongside Vanity Fair's Radhika Jones, who's made diversity her priority as editor-in-chief. Radhika, Ta-Nehisi Coates, thank you both very much indeed for joining me. Radhika, let me ask you first, what made you decide that this was going to be your September issue? I mean, I don't know, could you have known that George Floyd and Jacob Blake and all of, I mean, you decided this a long time ago, right?
No, actually, in terms of the usual amount of lead time for a magazine issue, we did this pretty quickly. What happened was we had been speaking with Ta-Nehisi about a different story. We were in dialogue together, and the George Floyd murder happened, and the protests began to spread around the nation, and our dialogue turned to the September issue, and we just thought, how can we capture this moment, which is obviously radiating back into history and radiating forward into the desperate need in America for justice? How can we capture it and capture the urgency of it? And so we set to work in early June and produced this issue of Vanity Fair, which we wanted to address everything that's happening in the country right now.
Well, this is really remarkable painting, cover, and we're going to get into a second. But let me ask you, Ta-Nehisi Coates, as guest editor, what were you laser focused on? You know, obviously, we've said that the issue is about art, activism, and 21st century America. What did you want your message to be?
I wanted to make something in partnership with Radhika and the staff at Vanity Fair and all of the writers and artists that we had assembled that would endure. I wanted to make something, I mean, this may sound overly ambitious, but that 100 years from now, when people look back at 2020, a period in which we had a plague that was killing an upwards of 150,000 Americans, when we had officers of the law who were shooting African-Americans down in their back, when they look back to try to understand what exactly happened, my hope would be, I think all of our hope was that, you know, this issue of Vanity Fair would figure fairly prominently in trying to understand.
Let's just talk about the image first, because in their back, in their beds, Breonna Taylor was shot, I believe, in her bed, certainly in her home. And as yet, there has been no justice and no accountability for those who did that. So I first want to ask you about the image. I'm calling it a painting because it was a painting originally. And it's done by Amy Sherald, whose first commission was to paint First Lady Michelle Obama for the Smithsonian. And this is her second commission. Talk, both of you, first of all, you, Radhika, about what her story. She's very determined and specific about what she was looking for and what she wanted to convey.
You know, it is, you're right, it is a painting that Amy made. And the reason that I thought of her for this work was, of course, I remembered and so admired her painting of Michelle Obama. And I also remembered the reaction to it. In particular, I remembered a photograph that went viral of a young Black girl looking at that painting and connecting so clearly to the figure of Michelle Obama. And I think Amy's art has the power to create that kind of emotional connection so that you're really seeing someone's life and their power and their purpose. And that was the spirit that we wanted this cover to have. So you're right, she was very determined and specific in her desire. We spoke to her about the process of making the painting, and there's a story in the magazine about it. And one thing that she says that really resonates with me is she talks about Breonna Taylor's gaze. Her gaze is strong. She's seeing you. She sees you look at her. And that the power of her presence and her gaze was very important to us.
And she talks also about the engagement ring, which she's painted on her wedding ring finger, that her boyfriend was going to give her, and of course the marriage that she never lived to have. And Ta-Nehisi, you talked to her mother, right? A huge long interview in the magazine is your conversation with her mother. You call it A Beautiful Life. What resonated with you about the story of Breonna's life?
Well, I think, you know, unlike with Jacob Blake, unlike with George Floyd, unlike with Tamir Rice, you know, so many of these cases that Black Lives Matter movement is organized around have been because the video was so appalling. And there was no video of the death of Breonna Taylor. And I was very struck when they released the police report that the police report was blank. And to me, what it kind of amounted to, taken all together, was the fact that many times if we can't see things, we have trouble believing, you know, that they were as, you know, horrible as, you know, people actually report them to be. That was one thing. But the second thing was also that her life would be erased. You know, when Tamika Palmer, Breonna's mother, when she thinks about her daughter, you know, she's very happy that, you know, she's become a symbol for the movement. But that is her daughter. That's a life. That's, you know, Breonna's not a slogan to her. She's an actual person. You know, she's somebody she, you know, gave birth to, somebody who she taught how to ride a motorcycle, someone who, you know, she prepared a special, you know, chili recipe with. Someone who was, you know, as she said, the glue for the family that got everybody together. And it's so important to remember that when these cops kill people, that they kill actual people, that they're not piling up numbers, that these are not digits. These are actual lives, people, children who folks have put energy into, who are completely erased off of the face of the earth. And so what we were trying to do was, you know, forgive the terminology here, but was to resurrect for a moment so that folks could remember that this was a life that was taken, that was erased off of the face of the earth for nothing.
Humanizing, I guess, is another way to say it. What did her mother think, Ta-Nehisi? Will she get justice, does she believe?
I don't know. I don't know if she believed. I didn't have the courage to ask her if she believed she would get justice. I just didn't have that in me.
Yeah. Yeah. And Radhika, what will happen to the actual painting? What do you plan to do with it?
That's up to the artist. That's up to Amy Sherald.
Yes. Yeah, as I was asking you, I thought, it's not yours, it's hers. It's obviously up to her. Well, we'll ask her when we get a chance. But listen, you have talked about creating a space for conversation. And I wonder, because now you have, you know, you've expanded your contributors list. I think Ta-Nehisi is going to remain as a contributor, not just a one-time guest editor. Tell me about space for these conversations. And we heard this week from the NBA as well. They created a space for a moment while they stopped playing for people to think about what was going on. And we understand they're going to have all their basketball arenas turned into voting places in November. Talk to me about the space for this kind of discussion.
I think it's the most important contribution that we can make, those of us who have platforms to use, you know, to edit a magazine really is to bring together a community of voices and artists and illustrators, photographers. And Ta-Nehisi and I know are so proud of all of the contributors to the September issue. And I want that spirit of community to continue. It feels to me that the role of a magazine or publication in this moment is that we can elevate and amplify the people we think are leading the culture forward. And that was what was behind our September project, and that continues to be an important part of my mission.
Mm-hmm. Ta-Nehisi, I want to ask you about one of the articles. It's called The Great Fire, Facing the Truth, and it's inspired by a poetry book of 1919. But in it, you have this passage. Whiteness thrives in darkness. It has to, because to assert itself in full view is to have one's own manners and morals degraded. And so evil does its business in the shadows, ever fearing not the heat of the great fire, but the light. To clearly see what this country has done, what it is still doing, to construct itself is too much for any human to take. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, that piece is inspired by my good friend Eve Ewing, who also contributed to the issue, taken from her book of poetry, 1919. But that, what you just read specifically, is, I would argue, inspired by one of our founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, who, you know, as I write in the piece, was never more persuasive and never more sublime than when he was articulating the burden of enslavement upon enslavers. And his whole point was, the act of enslaving is actually degrading to the enslaver. James Baldwin would echo this point years later. But that when you have to torture somebody, when you have to beat somebody, when you have to do all of the horrible things you have to do to keep somebody in their place, you in turn become a monster. You destroy your own humanity and you pass on that self-dehumanization to your kids, and they practice the same thing. And so it has effects. And so I think it's not so different than to be a citizen in this country with a certain amount of privilege to watch George Floyd be tortured to death for 8 minutes and say, yeah, I'm okay with this. That's fine. That works for me, and I'm okay with that, and that's the price of keeping me safe. That's an assault upon your humanity. You've gone somewhere. You've lost something. Some part of your heart and your soul has been taken if you can watch that video and be okay with it. And so I think, like, you know, that's always been, you know, key to the African-American struggle. You know, as I write now, from the time of the slave narrative to the time, you know, of the cell phone, from John Lewis, you know, on the bridge, and why that, you know, footage had such effect, to Emmett Till and the open casket funeral, and why that had such effect. It's very, very hard for people to witness what racism and white supremacy actually is. It's violence, it's force. And, you know, and do nothing about it. Now, the flip side of it is when people can hide it, you know, when they can, you know, commit those acts and not allow them to be seen, people are okay with it then.
And, I mean, you talked about the light. And, of course, what happened to George Floyd happened in full daylight. What happened to Jacob Blake was in the daylight. And, you know, that it's discouraging that. I just want to ask Radhika, you know, you weren't overtly political when we talked when you took over Vanity Fair. We talked about your heritage. We talked about your diversity priority. But you were, you know, hesitating about being overtly political, whether about racism or sexism or whatever it is. Have you changed? And do you believe that your magazine should actually take a political point of view? I mean, obviously, this one has. But do you think that's what Vanity Fair is going to do more of?
I think it's hard not to be political in this day and age. And I think about everything that's happening right now in our country. And, you know, we've come to a point where in the middle of a pandemic to wear a mask is apparently a political act. To declare that Black Lives Matter is apparently a political act. If that's political, then yes, please. I am political, and I think it's a magazine's role and even responsibility to advance arguments and ideas that open people's minds.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, especially for this time. Ta-Nehisi, lastly to you, there's another piece in this issue where it's talking about the abolition movement. And it says, from colonial times up through the Civil War, the largest police force in the country wasn't primarily found in the early towns or the bustling metropolises, but in the slave societies of the South, where to be a white man was to be deputized. That sentence is pretty profound, but I want you to reflect on it in terms of what has happened in Wisconsin. This 17-year-old white boy, you know, who's now charged with homicide, in, I believe the first degree, intentional, for allegedly killing two people, and videos that we haven't been able to confirm ourselves, but apparently show him and others with long guns walking past the police in Kenosha and being greeted, having water thrown at them. These are white militia vigilante groups. Can you just talk about that, please?
Yeah, such a great question. Just to take it back to the quote that you mentioned, it's difficult to get one's head around how much of policing actually has its roots in enslavement. But the sentence is literally true. To live in the South during the period of enslavement meant that you lived in a time of slave patrols where ordinary white men who, you know, either owned slaves or did not were basically deputized to patrol the roads for runaway slaves. But more than that, it basically meant that the entire white population had the power of arrest, of punishment, the power of just taking control of the body of any African American. In fact, often very, you know, either free or enslaved. That is the earliest form of police power in this country, and it stretches back to our very beginnings. And you know, as we argue, or as you know, the writer Josie Duffy Rice argues in the piece, we've never quite escaped that. And you can see the ghosts of it right in Kenosha, Wisconsin, where you have a 17-year-old white boy who is not, you know, a part of the police force, but is actually treated as though he were an extension of the police force. Shoots three people, walks down the street right past the cops, keeps going, and the cops keep going as though he did nothing. Because at least in his mind, he's one of them. And I think perhaps more importantly than the action of the video, which as you mentioned, you know, we haven't completely verified yet, it's the statements of the head of police in Kenosha the very next day. When he speaks of this shooting in the passive voice and attempts to equate the people who were protesting and were shot with the actual shooter. And it's the exact sort of passive voice language that you hear all the time when chiefs of police are often called to speak upon shootings that their officers perpetrate. And so it was almost as though that boy was an officer. And that's not a mistake. Whiteness and policing have been deeply intertwined from you know, both of their very earliest beginnings in this country. And to this very day, we're still paying the effects of it.
In the meantime, according to his father, Jacob Blake is in hospital, shackled to the hospital bed. Yes. Ta-Nehisi Coates, thank you so much. Radhika Jones, congratulations on the September issue. Thank you for joining us. Now, earlier, you heard former Senator Jeff Flake, a self-proclaimed Reagan conservative. Well, historian and journalist Rick Perlstein has been called the chronicler extraordinaire of American conservatism. His new book, Reaganland, the latest in a series exploring how conservative politics came to dominate American politics, retraces the events that propelled Ronald Reagan to the White House. And he tells our Walter Isaacson how it compares to President Trump's vision.
Thanks, Christiane and Rick Perlstein. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You've written now this fourth book on the rise of the new right in America. Tell me, how is what's happening now with Donald Trump, how does that resemble what happened with the rise of Ronald Reagan?
Well, I like to say history is a process, not parallels. And the process that produced Donald Trump were forged in this crucible of the movement that gave us Ronald Reagan. I was really struck looking through my book the other day at a quote that Pat Robertson, the televangelist who eventually, of course, ran for president as a Christian right candidate, what he said in 1978, he said, God wants stability. It's better to have a stable government under a crook than turmoil under an honest man, right? So in that sense, you can clearly see that there's nothing surprising that a movement like that would be galvanized by a Donald Trump if they believe that they're kind of getting what they want in terms of society of hierarchy and authority and all the usual right-wing values. But by the same token, Donald Trump and Ronald Reagan were very different people. Of course, Ronald Reagan cherished immigration when he gave his speech introducing his campaign for the primary in 1979. He proposed open borders between the United States and Mexico. But certainly the forces that brought him to the Republican nomination and then the presidency were full of the same sort of feral, reactionary rage that we see as the hallmark of the Trump era.
Well, let's start with those things that you said were differences. To me, mm-hmm. I covered the Ronald Reagan campaign when I was a reporter, and he seemed to exude optimism, a genuine right. sense of sunniness.
Right. He did. And that was absolutely crucial to his appeal. It's something he really introduced into conservative rhetoric, which, you know, sounded before Ronald Reagan became its dominant force, a lot like the kind of American carnage rhetoric we hear from Donald Trump. And he was extremely skilled at making public presentations that created a sense of comfort and ease, but often around the same sort of policies and the same sort of attempted outcomes as the more kind of feral and angry and rageful conservatism was calling for. And so he was adapted by the people who you know, for example, were weaponizing a fear and anger about gay rights, right? Even though he did not express that fear and anger in anything like the same unsavory terms.
One of the things that struck me in your book, because I was there, the Neshoba County Fair in Mississippi, mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan famously gives a speech in which he's in the environment where the Klan and racism and the murders of civil rights workers had happened. And it was supposed to be a bit of red meat for his right. followers. And yet he was oddly uncomfortable giving it. It was the worst speech he ever gave. Is that, that's right. sort of in yeah. your book.
His strategist knew that if he was perceived as a bigot, that he wouldn't be able to, you know, win those kind of swing voters, those moderate voters. And they made it absolutely central to his campaign for him to speak to as many African-American audiences as possible. In fact, the campaign was not supposed to open at the Neshoba County Fair. It was supposed to open at the Urban League Convention, the African-American Civil Rights Organization in New York. There was a schedule snafu. The Neshoba County Fair down the street from where three civil rights workers were lynched in 1964 ended up being the opening of the campaign. And the guy who picked him up at the airport was a young congressman, the chairman of his Mississippi campaign, Trent Lott. And he said, you know, you can really win over this audience if you mention states' rights, which of course was the sort of thing that racists have been using to, you know, advance the cause of white supremacy for generations in Mississippi. And Reagan takes his advice, but you can tell that he's uncomfortable with it, right? His most powerful psychological wellspring, really the foundation of his self-image, was that he was not he was a figure of innocence. You know, he was not an aggressive person, right? So the best way to kind of make Ronald Reagan lose his temper was to accuse him of racism. So you can see him delivering the speech, telling the usual jokes and stories that he tells, but he doesn't really stop telling the jokes and stories. He just keeps on going on and on. And finally, he makes his turn to, you know, his usual anti-government rhetoric, and he gets to this, and you can kind of feel the audience kind of draining away. And immediately afterwards, Jimmy Carter pounces, right? And he's accused by a group of Southern Democratic governors of being a carpetbagger. And the most fascinating document I was able to read was one in which an official of the Mississippi Democratic Party said, we had a chance for a landslide in Mississippi, but basically people in Mississippi don't want to be seen as, you know, the butt of the nation's derision for their racial past. And now it's a toss-up. There was actually a backlash against Reagan's backlash politics. That's another example in which we see that kind of difference between Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump. Often the policy goals are the same, but Reagan was very good at, you know, selling them with a smoothness and you know, kind of a domesticated anger. And just as an example of just how skilled he was, by the November election, he manages to win the endorsement of Martin Luther King's right-hand man, Ralph Abernathy. Martin Luther King's died in his arms, and he gave a rip-roaring speech for Ronald Reagan in a black church in Detroit a couple weeks before the election.
What's interesting to me is that Jimmy Carter was the first evangelical Christian to right. be elected president, does very well with the evangelical vote, and then quickly, within 4 years, the evangelical vote switches sides. Why is that?
Yeah, Jimmy Carter has a very old-fashioned and traditional sense of how a Southern Baptist should enter the public sphere, which was with a reluctance to bring his religion, you know, into political discussions, right? In fact, when he gives his famous interview in Playboy magazine, which is really the most deep, brilliant, thoughtful, interesting portrait of the mind of a presidential candidate we'd ever seen, that's specifically what he's trying to convince his readers. When he wanders into this theological disquisition, he says, I'm not going to be breaking down people's doors. He's not going to break down fornicators' doors, he says. And that segues into a discussion that begins when the interviewer, Robert Scheer, asks him if he's afraid of being assassinated. And he immediately takes that into a very deep place. And he says, no, me and Roslyn are not afraid of death because, you know, we've been washed in the blood of the Lamb. We believe in, you know, the hereafter. And that's when he starts talking about how he has lusted in his heart many times, but he knows that God has forgiven him. And the media does a terrible job with this. They immediately turn this into a giant joke. And that's when you begin to see the evangelicals taking a hard second look at him. This is a guy who, you know, is not reading fundamentalist theologians. He's reading Reinhold Niebuhr. You know, this is not a guy who's, you know, listening to Anita Bryant. He's listening to Bob Dylan. You know, he's speaking warmly of the Equal Rights Amendment. And the rest of the Southern evangelical movement, along with the rest of Christian fundamentalism, is making a turn towards politics in which those divisive social issues, those issues that have to do with kind of the social mores of the 1960s kind of entering the mainstream of American life, are becoming their political focus. This very apocalyptic fear that liberalism is taking over. And they begin to associate Jimmy Carter with those fears, such that by 1980, they're treating Jimmy Carter like he's Beelzebub.
The trajectory of your four books begins with the rise of Goldwater, but Goldwater gets wiped out in a massive landslide, seeding the ground to some ways for Ronald Reagan, who endorses him with a speech. How did that trajectory from the defeat of Goldwater so badly end up with landslide victories for Reagan not too much later?
Well, the process begins very soon after that, right? So my first book, Before the Storm, ends with all the pundits declaring the Republican Party dead and buried unless they purge conservatives because there's been such a mandate for liberalism. But only 2 years later, a lot of the people who lost office because liberals won on Lyndon Johnson's coattails got back in office. Ronald Reagan wins the election in 1966. And a lot of this is the racial backlash against what's happening in the streets. And a lot of this is the backlash against, you know, kids protesting against the Vietnam War. Pundits are always declaring, you know, conservatism a dead letter in American politics after liberals win, and it never is, right? It always kind of comes back like the monster in a Godzilla movie, you know. And the process I describe in all these books is the weaponization of the fear and the resentment and the anxieties about the social changes that are happening in America that eventually, you know, become accepted parts of American life. But when they are introduced to the scene, like the idea that gays and lesbians should have the same rights as everyone else, they're terrifying, right? And you can kind of use that terror to kind of frighten people into voting for candidates who, you know, come into office and do things like, you know, cut taxes for corporations, right? So that's a playbook that they've run again and again and again that reaches its modern apotheosis with Ronald Reagan and has kind of been repeated again and again, possibly with diminishing returns in 2020.
Let me push back on something you just said, which is that conservatism keeps roaring back like a monster. Why is it a monster in the sense it is tapping into things that people deeply feel and the liberals keep...
Let me address that very important question. If you look at Arthur Schlesinger's history of the New Deal and you read what conservatives were saying in the middle of the 1930s when Social Security was first propounded, they said it's going to destroy freedom in the United States. If you look at what Ronald Reagan said when Medicare was first propounded in 1961 and he, you know, recorded a medical or a record album for the American Medical Association to lobby against it, he said, if this passes, if old people get to get free health care out of Social Security, we'll be telling our children stories about what America was like when it was free. You heard the same thing about what happens if African Americans are afforded full civil rights in the South in 1964. The same thing you heard in 1977 and 1978 about whether gay Americans received full civil rights. It happens. The changes are frightening at first, but we eventually accept them as part of Americans' birthright as a free and equal nation. The next time some, you know, social change is proposed by liberals, you'll see the same panic, right? whether it's, you know, Arab Americans becoming American life, and then there's a terror over Sharia law. But, you know, the same pattern repeats itself, that the world doesn't end. That's the way the politics of reaction works. And we kind of divide the human estate of, you know, of people figuring out politics into, you know, a left wing and a right wing. And the left wing are the people who have their own flaws, but generally are more comfortable with expanding the ambit of freedom and liberty. And the right wing are the people who kind of use the fears over those changes in order to kind of gain and control power. You know, I think it's reached its apotheosis with Donald Trump. We've seen how dangerous and how ugly that can be when it kind of reaches its kind of most pure ore.
But don't you think the liberals are somewhat to blame for not understanding and not even feeling the true resentments, and perhaps even understandable resentments, people feel about the way the economy and, for that matter, foreign policy has been conducted?
Well, you know, the Democrats, I think certainly at their convention that we, you know, just saw, kind of shown themselves to be a pretty pluralist party. You know, you did have this priest, you know, kind of praying for the unborn in the womb, you know, at the same time as you saw, you know, very strong pro-choice elements, whereas, you know, the Republicans refused to have a platform. They basically just said, our platform is supporting Donald Trump, right? So, you know, I mean, there's nothing wrong with being a conservative, right? And there's nothing wrong with respecting the fears that people have about social change. I think the challenge of leadership in a diverse and pluralist society is to respect the necessity of change, but also kind of calm people's fears about anxieties that change brings.
What about the weaponization of resentment? How important is resentment in the rise of the new right?
It's absolutely crucial. That's the theme of my book, Nixon Land, in which the figure at its center, Richard Nixon, basically forms a social club for all the nerds at his college, you know, and kind of weaponizes their resentment against the cool kids who are in the fancy fraternity. And that becomes his political template. The nerds in his college fraternity become the silent majority in his famous speech of 1969, right? It's Sarah Palin, you know, talking about how all these kind of cosmopolitan intellectuals are trying to tell you that they're more moral and more smart than you are, you know, but really you're the smart one, right? So that sort of resentment at liberal cultural elites, as opposed to the resentment that the Democrats have traditionally mobilized for the working class, and their resentment of, you know, their bosses, you know, who are, you know, kind of telling them what to do at the workplace, is absolutely central to conservatism becoming a popular and not an elite movement, I should say.
Reagan used to use the old John Winthrop line about a city on a hill, shining city on a hill. And that was a sense of the belief in America. Why has that changed in the era of Donald Trump?
Yeah, that's a really fascinating quotation because in the hands of Ronald Reagan, it's actually 180 degrees the opposite of John Winthrop intended. When he said we're going to be a shining city on the hill, he meant everyone's going to be looking at us, so we really have to hold ourselves to a much higher standard of moral virtue. Ronald Reagan meant it as we're already the standard of moral virtue, and anyone who disagrees is maybe not quite American at all. It's really central to Ronald Reagan's appeal that he absolves America of their sins, right? He says America is not racist. You know, America is a force for good in the world. And it's these liberals who are kind of trying to apologize for America that are the problem. Jimmy Carter is the guy who says we need to make do with less. We have to sacrifice. Ronald Reagan is the guy who says, no, America, the American economy is this mighty dynamo. And the only reason it's not performing at full capacity is that these liberal regulators are, you know, have their foot on its neck. And I'm going to release that. I'm going to give a tax cut to everybody. Right. So the idea of the city and the hill in the hands of Ronald Reagan is a way of telling Americans that they don't need to kind of challenge themselves to a higher and more vigorous standard of patriotism. Patriotism is all about worshiping and celebrating this essential greatness of America that can only be befouled by foreign elements like liberalism, like bureaucrats.
Rick Perlstein, Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for your kind hospitality, Walter.
And an important historical reminder. And finally, as we've been reporting, today marks exactly 57 years since the biggest mass movement in civil rights history, the March on Washington, and the day Martin Luther King spoke the words, "I have a dream." Today, in an echo of the past, thousands rallied once again for justice. This time, they called it the Get Your Knee Off Our Necks March. After months of protests and global outrage over police brutality and racial injustice, demonstrators have gathered on those same steps at the Lincoln Memorial to demand, finally, change and equality. And Martin Luther King's family joined them to make this impassioned plea.
We are going to be the generation that dismantles systemic racism once and for all.
So if you're looking for a savior, get up and find a mirror. We must become the heroes of the history we are making.
And in light, of course, of all those victims that have come since, it is indeed emotional to hear almost 60 years later, the father and the grandfather who stood in that very spot. That's it for now. Thank you for watching and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.